Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to this week's episode of Firefly Willows LIVE. Our host this week is Mildred Lynn McDonald with Healing Conversations. Mildred Lynn will take you on a fascinating tour of the mind-body-spirit connection through a combination of healing conversations, hands-on personal growth tools, and a generous sprinkling of East Coast humor and warmth. Join her as she chats with P.J. Clark, owner of Serendipity Books and Gifts in Ottawa, Ontario. P.J. will share her vast knowledge of mind-body-spirit tools available for you today and her sage insights into what people are really looking for when they cross the threshold into her sacred healing store. And she'll talk with Terry Smith, who calls himself the Brand Guy. Terry will share how he manages to lead a balanced life and provides insights on what you can do each day to make the world a better place. Mildred Lynn also speaks with dog behavior specialists Tiffany Middleman and Aaron Phelps Pina, the inspired co-founders of Canine Paw Prints Rescue in California. They'll share the inside scoop on dog rescue shelters, dog behavior tips, and the benefits of adopting. We're excited. Give us a listen. Firefly Willows LIVE Roundtable is an opportunity for all of our hosts to come together and share their thoughts, experience, and insights on a variety of topics that are of particular interest to each of them. Listen in as each host takes a turn as moderator. Today's moderator is Mildred Lynn McDonald, and our roundtable topic is adaptability. Are you able to adapt to, and play with, the curveballs life throws at you?
Welcome, everybody. We're here in Studio C, Los Altos, California, and today we're going to be talking about the ability to adapt. But before we get into that conversation, I would like to welcome John Caracella.
Howdy.
Deb Caracella.
Good morning.
And Heisi Lutterbers.
Hello.
So adaptability, wondering what that means to you. For example, in my parents' generation, a person would have one job, they would stay there from start to finish, retire there, and then move on to the next phase of their lives. In today's society, people expect to have 7 to 12 or even more jobs. So people need to be able to adapt. And one model of adapting that may be applicable are the natural human changes that people make, such as moving from maybe daughter to wife to parent to grandparents. And I'm wondering, how can we take this natural rhythm of life and apply it to all the different changes that are coming down our path quicker than maybe some of us are comfortable with?
Well, I'm probably, out of our group, the least adaptable or the least comfortable with adapting. I like my structures, and I'm very comfortable within those structures. I'm not rigid, though. I believe that I do have some flexibility and open mind and the ability to adapt, and without a lot of pain and frustration and discomfort. But I prefer to stay on the path that I'm on and do things very slowly and with a great deal of contemplation. So the major adjustments that seem to be happening and the dynamic shifts that are occurring within society and within governmental models and across the world seem to be coming more and more rapidly than they did, as you mentioned, in our parents' day, even though they did deal with world wars and so forth. What happened at home wasn't as big and fast as what seems to be happening now in everyone's life. Things are changing, and they're changing faster than we are prepared or have in the past had to deal with. And how do we get there? How do we move into that gracefully, when most times we would rather look back over our shoulder and say, oh, can we just go back to that?
What makes it not second nature? What is it that happens when you face change, when you face the need to adapt?
The way I'm most comfortable operating is to have a sense of what's coming, to have a sense of what it looks like, what it will feel like, and to at least have the aura of having a little bit of control over what the circumstances will be and how I will fit into those circumstances. So when confronted with fast-paced change, there's not enough time or it doesn't feel like there's enough time to look at the scenario, look at the situation, and then see where I might fit into that. Facebook is actually a very good example of this. I hated Timeline, absolutely detested it. How dare they change everything and make all of us do it that way? It was perfectly fine the way it was. And eventually,
I did adapt,
but I was a holdout right up until the, okay, sorry guys, everyone's flipping over. So what I did was I found something that allowed me to come to it on my terms, and that was the banner picture that you have the option of doing. I would do something that I felt was my statement, which of course it was the purpose of it, and it was there for everyone,
yeah.
But it was like, okay, well, I have control over this, I'm taking it, and this is what I've chosen to do, and okay, fine, I'll go with it from here.
Anybody else have any thoughts on adaptation?
One, I think that Deb's not giving herself enough credit, because I think that you're conflating adaptation and change.
Okay.
And there's a difference, because for me, adaptation means our response to change versus the change itself. And
okay.
A lot of what you've described is you don't necessarily like change in general, but especially you don't like sudden change versus change you may know is coming, but you have time to prepare for it. Adaptation is our ability to deal with change and how we respond to change. And so you may be not giving yourself enough credit, like in your Facebook example.
Mm-hmm.
You adapted.
Right.
You didn't like the change.
Correct.
But it wasn't that you were unable or unwilling to adapt to the change. You didn't just say, okay, fine, I'm deleting my account. I'm never using Facebook again because if they're not going to do it the old way, I'm not doing it at all.
Exactly.
You
right.
actually adapted.
True.
You know, so I think that, and I think a lot of times we may not give ourselves enough credit, or we downplay what we're actually capable of doing, because we have to really pay attention to the terms and what do they mean. And here I would say change is what happens. Adaptation is how you respond to it. And I would also go back to what Mildred was talking about, comparing a parent's generation with today. Even though it seems as if, say, for example, people go through 12 or 17 jobs versus one job for 30 years, I think people today are much less adaptable. They're not nearly as skilled at being adaptable as people back then were. Because today, if the grocery store suddenly runs out of something, people don't know what to do. Back in the day, well, if the store didn't have something, then we have to figure out how to grow it ourselves. You just got used to the fact, and you had time. It's like, well, I have time to grow my own tomato plant because there isn't going to be tomatoes at the store this season for whatever reason, so I can figure out how to adapt and deal with that. Whereas now, people are like, well, the grocery store doesn't have tomatoes. I don't know what to do because I'm having a dinner party tonight. By tomorrow night, we need, you know, something else, and we haven't figured out how to resolve the tomato issue. But I just think that the rapidity of change nowadays actually lessens the ability to adapt, because you never actually have, you don't really have time to even respond or react before the next change is coming.
Mm-hmm.
Facebook is a good example. By the time you've figured out what they've changed and where something now is and what you're supposed to do, they're already changing it again. You don't even have time to utilize it,
right.
Let alone figure out fully how it works. And so you aren't really getting the chance to experience adapting, nor develop the skill of adapting. I know this will sound really odd, but this is where perhaps there is a benefit, say with the, over the past couple of years, like the unemployment situation, and there's a lot of people who are out of work for 6 months, 8 months, or a year, rather than being out of work for 3 weeks and then you start a new job. Having that larger length of time means you actually have a better opportunity to adapt or respond differently. You don't just rush to the next job. You can now go and take classes to learn a new skill. So when you do go back into the workforce, you've actually adapted better because you've learned something that is more current, and you have adapted to how things operate now, and you can go into a new job better skilled, better prepared, et cetera, versus just jumping from one thing to another and then hoping that you're going to pick up what you need in the new thing because you didn't have any time in between the last thing and this thing to do that.
Does anybody see a correlation between the different stages in life and our ability to adapt to those stages in terms of transference of those skills or transferring of that mindset or heart set.
That you articulated roles and stages mm-hmm. in life, those are, in some sense, archetypes. An archetype is only as good as its ability to transfer skill or awareness. The reason we look to archetypes is that they inform us in some way about the world we're living in and our ability or possible ways of engaging. As change happens more and more rapidly, and even, you know, you can look at this from generation to generation, right? The ability of those archetypes, those very localized archetypes, to transfer knowledge in the presence of very rapid change actually diminishes. That's one of the reasons the generation gap exists. The generation gap exists in an accelerated, more visible form because of the rate of change. What being a grandfather meant to my great-grandfather is not anything like what being a grandfather means to me. So what I've been observing is that we actually have to re-examine what we take from archetypes. And inevitably, it leads me into more the mythological archetypes. Because the mythological archetypes are the ones that, irrespective of the grand arc of change, remain relevant.
So they're timeless.
They're timeless. Yeah. They retain their relevancy as lenses through which to interact with the world. You can use the more localized, more personal archetypes to the extent that they're useful, but remember and be aware of the fact that, well, you know what, being a grandpa is not the same as it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
And so the grandpa archetype, you have to be thoughtful and sensitive about what you take from it. You asked a slightly different question, which is how do you use those stage of life archetypes to work with change in other areas? And this time I wanted to get back to something that you said about structure, right? And Deb talked about how it'd be nice, it's nice if she knows what's coming and if she has some controls in place and some structures in place with which to address that change, right? Basically to catch the change and, you know, fit it into place. And I wanted to suggest that there's two ways for that control structure to be experienced. One is to have the structure outside of yourself, is to prepare physically, to prepare mentally and emotionally, to have contingency plans and so on and so forth. And I would put that under the domain of control. The other place to put those structures is inside yourself, where you acknowledge that what's changing outside of you is not under your control. And the only thing that is under your control, as I see put it, is your response to it, your adaptability. So you establish inside yourself a set of disciplines that allow you to examine the state of the world in the presence of change and know that it's your responsibility to be in a place where you can adjust. And I would call that mastery.
And maybe in a simpler even way, what you're calling mastery can also be about when we use the term, if you have done the work to be grounded and centered, then you are going to be able to deal with and respond to whatever change comes without it knocking you over.
So if you were going to share a tip with our listeners in terms of, this is what I've used to seamlessly, smoothly, gracefully, in integrity, adapt to change, what would it be?
No matter how challenging or miserable life is, it's always fascinating.
So you gain strength from the vibration of fascination. How about anybody else?
Discovery. The newness is, I guess, the fascination part for me, because there is something very intriguing and something very welcome about doing something new, discovering something new. Not only the newness of what's coming at you, but the newness of who you are and the newness of how you respond to it. I find that that's part of the process of encountering change and then flowing with it and so, being able to adapt with
it. So you value the discovery and the newness aspect.
Mm-hmm.
So John is fascination, you're valuing discovery and newness. And what about you, Heisi?
The idea of evolution has, I'll be gracious and say, it's been misconstrued for what a lot of people think that evolution means. And actually, the primary tenet of evolution is not the strongest survives, but the most adaptable survives. That would show that if we stop adapting, we stop evolving. And if we stop evolving, then we're not growing, we stagnate, and ultimately we die. Now, that could tie into the phases of life, because by the time you hit the oldest phase of life, you kind of stop changing or adapting the way that you did or that generations younger than you did. One of the things that I think we've lost that is very important for helping to remember how to do that as well as to make those transitions when change and adaptation comes along is ritual. Because there used to be very ritualized things, and you still see it in certain cultures and communities, between when a child moved from one age range to the next. There are rituals for when a girl has her first menstruation period, when a person reaches a certain age and is moving into what might be called cronehood or the sage phase. So you have kind of this ritual that acknowledges that, that honors that, and also does not suddenly diminish or cause the person to disappear. Using ritual, even in a small way, I think is a very effective way to deal with change and adaptation, because if you can't, and I don't think that we really should try to, stop change or prevent change, then do a ritual to honor what it is that may have moved out or gone away, but also do something to welcome in and express receptivity, if not gratitude, for what is coming in. And that can be as simple as standing on a hilltop and saying goodbye, or it can be something more complex. But I think if you bring an aspect of ritual in when there are significant changes happening as you're trying to adapt to what that change is, it helps in the transition process and gives you a tangible and a kind of a visceral sensation of letting go, not feeling as if you've lost something versus simply something has moved out and moved away, but there's something new coming in, and it makes it less fearful.
Yeah, really nice, Heisi. So just to recap, John is our fascination man. Deb is discovery and newness. Heisi is ritual. And I would use the energetic vibration of core for me. When I'm going through change and I'm observing myself and how I'm adapting, what is intriguing to me is how that change intersects with my core. It took me a long time to divest myself of all the fluff. And I know that that core can make it through any change.
I would ask you, what is the core when the change is death?
Well, to me, my core is my spirit.
So it would survive.
That's what I believe.
The reason I bring that up is that's by way of illustrating, illuminating that there is no change that your core will not survive.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true for all of us, that there is no change through which we cannot successfully pass. As long as we are willing to shed that which no longer serves us in the presence of that change.
Mm-hmm.
And the core, even if it's someone else dying that we're trying to deal with, because that's also something we have to adapt to.
Mm-hmm.
You could say that it's, because oftentimes you'll hear people say, well, what got you through that? And they'll say it was my core beliefs. And so that core is also, I've spent time understanding my relationship and my theory about death, so that when it does happen, not necessarily to me, but somebody else that somehow is in my life, it doesn't just shake me and throw me off. And I think that's what we see in our society a lot, because we tend to put death way over here and pretend like it doesn't exist in a lot of ways.
Or
and
do.
Then it's so hard for people to deal with. And then we think we have to do something so elaborate and spend so much money to somehow, like with the funeral and all of that. But if we have that core belief can simply be, well, I've made my peace in understanding with what death is. So I may still be sad and certainly miss a person, et cetera, but it's not going to totally cause me to never leave my house for 2 years because I can't figure out how to deal with this or get through this, versus that core is where I can come back to, because that's that grounding, that centering place, that stable place that I can come back to that says when I'm wavering, I go back there and it helps me to regain my balance.
Great point.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's our roundtable for this week. Many thanks to Mildred Lynn McDonald and participants Deb and John Carosella and Heisi Lutmers. Next week, our roundtable moderator will be Heisi Lutmers. We hope you found this roundtable discussion engaging and thought-provoking. If you would like to join the conversation, visit facebook.com/fireflywillows and add your comment under this week's roundtable post. Stay tuned. A personal tarot reading can offer you insight, information, enlightenment, and empowerment along your life's path. Hi C is a professional tarot conversationalist and ritualist with over 10 years' experience. He's available for readings in a variety of formats, including parties and events. To schedule your personal tarot reading, contact Hi C at tarotbyhic.net or email him at hic@fireflywillows.com. Welcome back. This is your host, Mildred Lynn McDonald, and you're listening to Healing Conversations from Los Altos, California. In a few minutes, we'll head to Ottawa to join PJ Clark, the creative force behind the trailblazing metaphysical haven, Serendipity. PJ will recommend great life tools that will help you navigate through health, career, love, grief, even death. She'll also share why she loves her work, stays so balanced, and finds her clients absolutely fascinating. Then we'll beam over to the East Coast of Canada, where Terry Smith, a branding expert, humanitarian, and songwriter, will take us on an inspiring personal journey in the Dominican Republic. Fast forward to today, and a school is thriving and educating over 200 Haitian children. How did he do it? What has he learned? Is this something you and I can do too? In our last segment, we'll zoom over to Pittsburgh, California. You'll really enjoy our conversation with canine behavior specialists Tiffany Middleton and Erin Phelps-Pina. These two dedicated gals are the inspired co-founders of Canine Paw Print Rescue. Listen as they share the inside scoop on dog rescue, dog behavior, and the benefits of adopting. And now let's join PJ Clark in Ottawa, Canada. For our listeners out there, I'm talking with PJ Clark, who is the owner of Serendipity Books and Gifts in Ottawa, beautiful Ottawa, Canada. PJ, I'd love to ask you, how did you come up with the name Serendipity?
Now, that's an interesting little story, because when I was thinking about opening this store, I was thinking about calling it Serenity. And the whole day long before I went to register, I could only think of Serendipity. Every time I wanted to think of Serenity, Serendipity came up. Serendipity, in the short form, means happy discoveries by chance.
Oh, okay. What do people usually say to you when they enter the store?
They say, "It feels so wonderful in here. Can I stay?" And then, of course, they want to know what it is. Why do they feel different in the store? Sometimes they just start talking, and they stop and look at me with these big eyes and say, "I have no idea why I'm telling you this." I reassure them that it's okay, because it happens all the time, and it's just a safe, comfortable environment for them to be in, and so they open up.
What do you find people are usually looking for when they come to visit you? Like you mentioned that sometimes they don't even know.
They're looking to feel better, okay. Essentially. I mean, certainly some people come in and they think it's a gift store, and so they're looking for gifty kind of items. Often people just come in and they need help. Okay. They're stressed. They're not coping. They want help. And they've probably heard on the radio about energy, or maybe they've heard from a practitioner that there's other tools, alternative ways of doing life out there, and so they've come looking for help. They bring lists with them, and they have books that they're interested in, or they have a list of stones. Perhaps they're going to take a shamanic workshop. We work through what it is that they need.
And when they come into your store, what's your process for helping them connect with the tools that they need or the tools that they're looking for? Because I know you're very, very skilled at this.
Mm-hmm. First of all, we have a little conversation so that we can narrow it down a little bit to find out how they're feeling. And sometimes people don't even know how they're feeling because they're processing everything in their head. If they say, I'm not really feeling very good today. I'm just off. I ask them if they want to be smudged, and maybe we can cleanse their energy field a little bit to see if that will help. And sometimes they say yes. Most of the time they say yes. I don't remember actually any time somebody said no. We have more of a conversation about what they require. Where do they want to go? Do they want to listen to some lovely music? Do they need some scents? Do they need some crystals? And sometimes they just look at me and say, I don't know where to start.
And for the listeners out there who are not familiar with smudging, could you quickly share what that is?
It's a native practice, a shamanic practice, actually, and that's throughout the world, but more so in North America. They use white sage. And so we light the sage, and then it smokes. Then I waft the smoke all around the outside of their energy fields. And from the shamanic practice with the gentleman who is a shamanic healer in Serendipity, he's told me a particular way of doing it, and so that's how we do it. And people are amazed at how much better they feel because they've collected some heavy energy, maybe just as they've been out on the street, or maybe they've been in a mall, and maybe they're particularly sensitive to energy. They just feel so much better when their energy fields are cleared a little.
And when we last talked, you were telling me that when challenging situations show up in your life, you share that you were pretty much at peace because you have the tools to help navigate through the situation. So could you share with our listeners what this means? Because when you said that to me, that really hit my heart.
The metaphysical world, the spiritual world, is a process that we're all working through. Because I live in it 24/7, essentially, I have a very strong awareness of what's going on in my life. When there's a challenge that comes up, I have an ability to step out of the energetic charge and look at what's actually happening without being drawn into the drama of what's happening. And that's a very, very powerful tool.
When challenging situations show up in your life, you feel a sense of peace because you have the tools that will help you navigate through them. Can you share a little bit what that means to you?
We have tangible tools, and I happen to use several different decks of oracle cards, plus I use a deck of tarot cards, and I sit in meditation every morning with my cards. That's one of the more practical tools that I use. I also have an ability to detach from the energy charge of a challenging situation so that I can sit back and view what's going on from a greater perspective. Usually, there's a message there for me. And so within meditation, I can usually figure out what that is.
So what it sounds like to me is that you have taught yourself through using tools how to detach and become the observer. From that perspective, you're able to diffuse the charge of the energy that would make you become dramatic or emotional or whatever. And a lot of the information in your store, in whatever form it's in, either CD or music or book or cards or sculpture or whatever, can all function in that form.
Absolutely.
Serendipity offers information sessions every Thursday evening. Because you've been doing this for 10 years, what topics are popular and how has this changed through the years?
I don't think that it's changed a great deal because we seem to be changing the customers that come in. People come and go, and we continue to offer crystal ball meditations, which is a sound healing tool, and Jeremy Seals is a sound healer, and we've been offering those for many, many years, and we still get some of the older people coming in, but often we get new people as well. We do workshops on dreams and chakras and how to read oracle cards. Presently, we're doing how to read tarot card workshop. Down the road, coming in and doing a workshop on astrology. Somebody else who is an NLP practitioner and a hypnotist will be offering a series of workshops on changing your way of thinking.
Now, NLP, just for our listeners who are not familiar with this, what would that stand for?
Neuro-linguistic programming. Well, you know when you get caught up in a thought and you keep replaying it again and again and again, and it's not a particularly positive thought, people don't know how to not do that. It's about re-channeling that information so that you can think about something differently.
Now, on a personal level, what are you drawn to these days?
Every morning I go for a walk down by the river with the trees, and then I sit in meditation, as I said, with my tarot cards. Just connect with the day, essentially.
I've attended a number of your workshops when I was in Ottawa or living in Quebec, and I was always impressed, PJ, because you would sit there, and then you would ask the most insightful questions.
I must have been channeling. Just kidding.
And now that I reflect on it, you truly were showing up and present in the role of the observer, because the questions always came from the space of non-judgment and observation.
Our audience often is new to whatever we're presenting in the store, so they probably wouldn't even know what question to ask. I have a sense that whatever the practitioner is presenting, if they're not touching on certain things that come up for me, then I ask the question.
Everything in serendipity is an integrity with who you are as a human being. There was a very, very popular bestseller that were people were even coming into your store asking for, and because it was not in integrity with your energy and what you believed in your integrity, you made the choice not to have it in the store, but you were also generous in terms of saying, I don't carry it, but these stores do carry it. Yeah, has that happened a lot over the last 10 years, or was that a one-off?
Not so much with a particular book or a particular item, but sometimes it happens with a particular practitioner or a teacher. Their energy has to be in alignment with the store, so that I feel comfortable that whoever's coming in will be well supported.
So if someone wanted to come in and ask you about chakras, what would you recommend?
The first book that comes to mind is Anatomy of the Spirit by Carolyn Mace. Somewhere in the book it says, your biology is your biography. How you live your life will determine your well-being. And she uses all kinds of stories, and there's a chart in there, and I just think that it's a great book. There are some that are a little bit more simple, Chakra Clearing by Doreen Virtue and The Seven Energy Centers by Elizabeth Prophet. They also have a wonderful chart that gives you a little bit of information about all the different aspects of chakras, and I use that a lot as well. Plus, we have color energy for the particular chakras, and candles, incense, and several other books as well.
Now, what if someone walked through the door and they were just vibrating in stress? Their nerves were rubbed raw.
I wouldn't use a book necessarily for stress, because everybody's stress is different. I think we would have a little bit of a conversation about what it is that's stressing them. And as we said earlier, about maybe getting grounded, because I think a lot of people are not grounded. They're in their heads, and they need to understand the concept of getting back into their bodies. So I tell them to go and hug a tree, lay in the grass, or if they can't do that, then perhaps have a bath with some Epsom salt so that they can just start to relax, and then maybe find some lovely music. There's all kinds of lovely music available by Aeolia and Merlin's Magic and Snadam Kaur and Diva Pramel. These are all beautiful CDs that can help calm you down. Actually, I had a lady in the store the other day. She was very much like that, and And I had to show her how to breathe, because a lot of people don't even know how to breathe into their belly. And she came back a few days later and said, it worked. It really worked.
Now, if they did the grounding and they did the breathing and they were interested in a book, if they did those two steps, is there anything that you carry that you could recommend?
For de-stressing or for improving their life? Full Catastrophe Living by John Gabbett-Zinn, and Where You Go is another one of his books.
Okay.
There You Are, Where You Go, There You Are.
Oh, okay. Where You Go, There You Are. Gosh, that resonates
yes.
with me.
yeah, for sure. Debbie Ford, who I know that you're familiar with, The Right Questions.
That's an excellent book. That's almost mm-hmm. what I would call a no-brainer. A lot of people who are stressed or fatigued, their mind is cluttered, and they're
yeah.
you know, they're not clear. So even something as simple as finding the next step takes a lot of energy. And that's why I really like that particular book, because it's very straightforward and clear. You're given a question. You don't have to think up the question. You're given the question. So then then the impetus is on you to apply it to your life. Now, let's say someone came in and they or someone in their life was at that transition point of passing over. Anything mm-hmm. there that you could share?
Several books by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. And I think that they could be very, very useful.
Looking to have a healthier lifestyle, what would you recommend?
I would suggest that they think about what they're eating, for starters. And there is a new book, and I know you're going to ask me the title of it, but I haven't received it yet, so I don't know what it is. But it's this gal who's written Listening to Your Body. And instead of being in your head and telling your body what you want to eat today, your body is telling you. So it's not about dieting. It's about listening to your body. Maybe it needs more protein that day or something like that. But, you know, maybe I shouldn't even be talking about this because I don't know the title.
When we have the title, we'll put it on the Firefly Willows Live website and people can act there. Yeah, but it just makes you sound more real and approachable, PJ, because that's one thing I've always liked about you. You never found it necessary to have all the answers.
No. I don't profess to have all the answers, that's for sure. But I think some kind of meditative process is really essential for everybody today. And it doesn't have to be 10 or 20 minutes or half an hour or whatever. It could just be 1 or 2 minutes a few times a day. And I really encourage people to try that
okay.
before they start their day. But everybody's lifestyle is different. So if you could just do a little bit, I think you would find a huge difference.
Almost you could do a step-by-step or minute-by-minute.
Even
a minute in the energy of meditation or nature makes a huge difference to your body. Huge.
Yeah, yes. It is about getting grounded. And when people are stressed or unhealthy, a lot of it is because they are in their heads, they're scattered, and they're not grounded, and they need to come back and get back into their body.
Mm. Now, what about career change? You haven't lived until you've changed your career.
When I think about that, if they are thinking about changing their careers, then I feel they need to get into their heart and think about what makes their heart sing. Or in the process of opening the store, my daughter gave me a book called Starting a New Business the Buddhist Way. When I was reading this book, what really, really jumped out at me the most was, what did you do as a child? What did you really, really like to do as a child? Because that way you'll find what makes your heart sing.
And what about love and relationship?
5 Love Languages by Dr. Chapman. And unfortunately, I think you can only get it on his website. And what that book does is tell you how people love differently. So if you're in a relationship where you don't think your partner is loving, it could be that they're expressing it in a way that you haven't understood as love. I found it a wonderful read. There's a few others, The Mastery of Love by Don Miguel Ruiz and The Four Agreements by him.
Okay, and PJ, what about yourself? I know that we've had a conversation about a special book that we have both read, and people out there might be interested in getting that information too.
Absolutely. It's Oneness by Rasha. I have sold so many of that book to people who have been on their spiritual journey for quite some time. It's a guidebook, and it's not for people who are just starting out, because the language in the book would not be familiar to them. So people who have been on their journey for a while and understand the concept of being spirit housed in a physical body and that they came here with a particular purpose would understand where this book was going.
So that's, again, the book is Oneness. And for the listeners out there, my experience with this book is that you savor it. So I would eat one or two pages. Well, actually, I believe I was ingesting the energy of the book. And then I would luxuriate in the concepts that I had just been exposed to. And I savored that book. And when I finished it, I went right back to the beginning again. So it's a companion book.
Absolutely. I use it pretty much every morning. I just open it. And that's actually how I connected with the book originally. The gal who had ordered it came and picked it up right away, and I hadn't had an opportunity to get my nose into it. And three lines, I think it was, and thought, oh, this is for me. Just gives me goosebumps thinking about it, talking about it.
Now, PJ, I always ask myself, who do I need to be to show up for people to be able to do energy healing work? And what it really means for a lot of energy healers and adjuncts of that is, you need to be in balance. You need to be able to nourish yourself. You need to be strong. So what do you do to nourish yourself, and where do you get your strength?
I believe I get my strength from many different areas. With being in the store, I'm continuously in that energy, that very high vibration, the positive energy. But there's also a reciprocity that's going on with the people who come into the store. I learn from them when they're in the store learning from me or the tools that are here in the store. I also try and keep my life really simple as I can, because I am very sensitive to energies. And so often I can't go into shopping malls or where there's large groups of people. That's what I mean about keeping my life simple. So I spend time with my children and my granddaughter. They have wonderful energy because they're aware of being on a spiritual path as well. And people who I have met over the years who are interested in the metaphysical world, we go and sit in cafes and have a glass of wine and have a great conversation. That nourishes me. I think a lot of it has to do with taking care of your physical body, though, and being strong. I still have to sleep a lot and drink water. And so I'm very careful about what I eat, how much sleep I get, getting some exercise every day, so that I am strong and I am healthy and I can show up every day. And because I love what I do and I walk the talk, I think that's where it all comes together.
Yeah, and it sounds that you're always very present. When I'm in your company, I don't have the sense that you are talking to me, but you're thinking of five other things on your to-do list. And I've noticed that when you're speaking with other people, that you are very, very engaged in the moment.
I know people have said to me, I don't know how you could stand there and listen to all of that all of the time. And I said, well, I find it fascinating. Everybody has a story, because our lives are made up of stories. And some people don't have anybody else to talk to. I had this gal in the store on Saturday, and she's had a very traumatic experience and has nobody to talk to. And so it's comforting. I guess I'm a good listener.
I think you're an excellent listener. And speaking, PJ, of listening, what are people struggling with? What are they coping with, and what aren't they coping with?
It could be that it's just the area that I'm living in, too. Ottawa is a government town, so I think there's a lot of fear in the collective consciousness right now because of the downsizing of the government. And I think that's what people are trying to cope with fear. And how are they going to change their lives if they lose their job? Then that falls into stress as well. So in this immediate area in the capital, I would say that that's what people are dealing with.
Okay. And here's a question for you. Having had your store for 10 years and having lived your life, being a wonderful listener and finding people fabulously interesting, what have you really learned about life and people and cycles?
I guess probably one of the major things that I've learned is that life is like peeling away the layers of an onion. You think that you've just dealt with a whole series of things in this area of your life, and you're not going to have to do it again. And lo and behold, it's there again. And you think, what? I already did that. Aren't you done with that? And then, so over the years, I've realized, I don't know that you're ever done with it whilst you're here, because you're just peeling away the layers.
It's almost as if you work something through and then the universe gives you the gift of seeing if you have really worked it through. Or you worked it through on a Monday. Let's see if you've worked it through on a Friday or a Thursday or a Wednesday or a Tuesday.
And that's exactly what happens. It's almost, okay, well, I'm done with that, and then you get a test. So how far have you come from the last time you did it? That's a wonderful signpost for all of us, you know. Okay, well, I didn't fall apart quite so much this time. You're doing really well.
I know someone's listening, and they really like what you have to say. And perhaps you've inspired some people to consider opening up their own serendipity or their own version of serendipity, which I look at as a sacred space. What would you like to say to that person?
Mm-hmm. Seriously, I guess. Some very practical advice. This is multi-layered, like everything else is. Practical advice in terms of the business aspect of it, I would say, if at all possible, to buy the building that you're going to house your shop in. And also to align it with perhaps a facility that offers spa-like treatments, or a tea shop or a coffee shop that has really yummy goodies in it. That way, you'll have a continuous flow through your store, and that way you will capture people who may not necessarily understand what a metaphysical store is about. The other thing that I would suggest is that in order for you to have time for yourself, you might want to have volunteers come into the store. You can make some kind of exchange that way in the beginning, you know, whether it be a service or some product instead of an income. The other thing is you have to walk the talk, and you can't make it about money. You create your own reality, and what you put out there is what you bring back to you. You can't be always worrying about the bottom line. I truly believe if you're in the flow, if you're passionate about what you do, if you've been guided by the universe to show up and open this store for your community, then the universe will support you.
Excellent sage advice to end our healing conversation with. But on a positive note, PJ, would you be interested in coming back again to talk to our listeners? Because I have a feeling that you have more layers of that onion that you could share with people.
I would love to. I would love to participate in this with you, Mildred Lynn.
Oh, thank you so much. And if anybody's interested in getting a hold of PJ, PJ, could you share your contact information, please?
Absolutely. My phone number in Ottawa is 613-722-3400. We will have a website operational, hopefully within the month, and that's serendipitybooks-gifts.ca. And if you wish to send me an email, and I'd be happy to help anybody who's interested in opening up their own store, if I can help in any way, I'd be only too happy to. And you can email me at info at serendipitybooks.ca. serendipitybooks-gifts.ca.
For everybody else out there, if you would like to re-listen to PJ's healing conversation today, simply replay the internet radio show. It'll be in the archives. There's been a lot of wonderful, wonderful information shared today and information that you can digest and action. So just wanted to throw that out there in case someone's their arm is falling off and they're wondering, how am I ever going to remember all of this? So PJ, thank you very much. Have a wonderful afternoon in Ottawa. We will be in touch soon.
Thank you so much, Mildred Lynn. It's been my pleasure.
Thanks, PJ. And if any of our listeners would like to enjoy PJ's interview again, please go to our archives at Firefly Willows Live. The shows are also available on iTunes and at Blog Talk Radio. In our next segment, we'll sashay over to Cape Breton Island, where Carrie Smith, brand expert, humanitarian, and songwriter, will take us on an inspirational personal journey to the Dominican Republic. As shared earlier, Carrie was instrumental in creating a school opportunity for over 200 Haitian children. He's also an active board member on Servants Heart, an organization that operates schools and medical clinics in impoverished communities. Let's find out what Carrie has to say about giving and learning and growing and connecting heartbeat to heartbeat. After our visit with Carrie, we'll have a chat with the founders of Canine Paw Print Rescue. They'll offer insightful front-line perspective on dog rescue shelters, dog behavior, and the benefits of adopting a rescue animal. For sure, after listening to what Tiffany and Aaron have to say, you too will understand what it means to have paw prints on your heart. This is Mildred Lynn McDonald. We hope that you're enjoying the show today. And now, without further ado, let's join Terry Smith at his home on the beautiful Mira River in Cape Breton. I'd like to welcome you here today. And how is the weather in Cape Breton?
Beautiful. It's actually been beautiful for, about a week and a half at least here. And the sun is shining, and I'm looking out at the beautiful Mira River, and it's just a glorious day.
Some people would say you're living the Cape Breton dream.
Well, I think I am. I'm very blessed.
Now, I'd love for you just to give our listeners a little bit of information about the work that you've been doing in the Dominican Republic, and then we'll roll into some questions.
Sure. It was back in 2006, actually, that I had heard a presentation of somebody talking about the struggle of Haitian people that live in the Dominican Republic. A lot of people don't realize it, but Haiti itself has many problems, but estimates are about 2 million Haitians that live in the Dominican Republic, and most of them are illegal, but they've come over to work in sugarcane plantations and things like that, and found that life was a little bit better, and so they didn't go back. But because they're illegal, that means that they usually don't have access to public education or healthcare and things like that. So hearing about that, I felt compelled to do something. And my wife and I had an opportunity to travel down and get a sense of what was happening there on the ground. And we came away with a sense that we wanted to raise funds to build a school in one of these Haitian communities. Over a number of years, actually, we were able to partner with some other organizations who helped us raise funds, helped send people down to work alongside local tradespeople to do the construction. And September 2010, the school did, in fact, open, and it's just about to start its third year. So that kind of was the start of us, and we've been down there six different times on humanitarian trips where we're working in that community and doing some work in other communities. And we've really gotten to know a lot of people, and it's really been a relationship that has been beneficial, I think, in both directions.
Now, Terry, how does it feel to leave one culture and immerse yourself in another?
Well, I guess before going, I had a little bit of excitement. I'm a person who likes to travel and new cultures, so there was some of that. But I guess at the same time, I had a little bit of trepidation because I thought, okay, I'm going to be looking at poverty square in the eye, and I just was trying to mentally prepare myself for something that might be a little bit difficult to experience. And I guess three impressions I came away with were that poverty in a material sense in no way equals misery. I met some of the happiest people that I've ever met in my life who, you know, have little more than clothes that are on their backs. I also really came to understand that they have a simplicity in their lifestyle that I come back home and I get involved in the busyness of day-to-day, the day-to-day grind here, and I kind of long to be back there with them and just experiencing that simple life where just a little conversation or doing a simple task is just such a big part of your day. And I guess I came away with understanding that, I suppose in the back of my mind, I thought that I'm coming from a wealthy Western country, bringing resources down to these poor people, that I was the one who was being charitable and giving. I quickly learned that it was just crazy, actually, when I got down there, because I quickly learned that I had so much to learn from them, and I came away thinking, yeah, I am giving to them in a sense, but I felt like they were giving me so much in return, and it was just a lot to learn.
So would you say when you and Stephanie first were touched by the inspiration to build some schools for the Haitian people in the Dominican Republic, where did that hit you? Did that hit you in your heart, in your spirit? I'm trying to visualize you guys when you both decided, we can do something about this.
At the time, my company was just about to mark its 10th anniversary, and along with my team, we were talking about doing something to give back in some way to mark that. Then I heard this presentation. It was something that just really strongly resonated with me, and I knew I'm supposed to do something. I had no idea how to do it, and then it was amazing once you kind of decide you're going to do something and then take a step in that direction, you know, things just started falling into place. It was quite an adventure.
Yeah, and that's really good for our listeners to consider. When destiny calls or destiny knocks, something that's in your highest purpose to explore or action, I always call it a knowing. It's not even on a logical plane. You know, like you have an arm or you have a leg. It's that strong of a knowing. And the trick is to pay attention to that like you did.
Yeah, and to not be afraid of it, because we had no idea what this was going to be. It was just, well, let's take a step in that direction and see what happens.
Nothing ventured, nothing gained.
Yeah.
Now, as you move back and forth between the Western culture and the culture and a completely different type of culture, what frustrated you? Because I remember going to a country at one point, and then I came back to my real life, and it took a little while to get those perspectives to mesh together. And I remember feeling some frustration, actually frustration at how much we waste.
There is definitely frustration on how much we waste. And I guess my mindset frustrated me. Every trip I would come back with a motivation to do something more. And I guess I always felt like I wasn't doing enough. Time passes and your everyday life issues start coming to the forefront, and then you find yourself maybe where you were so motivated to do something, slowly and slowly it kind of subsides. That was a personal frustration of mine. I do think as well our society just to, like you said, we can be very wasteful, but also I think our society can be detrimental to us having some kind of lasting growth. You know, I don't consider myself to be materialistic, but I often spend my time and resources on things that if I really sat back and looked at them, they're driven by society rather than driven by what's in my heart. You know, the Haitian people that I got to meet, they're so focused on just the daily survival, and there's none of this societal push for more, more, more. It almost puts them in a mindset of just enjoying one day at a time. I think there's a sense of peace that comes from that. It really frustrated me that I can see that and experience it, but then I come back home and it just fades away.
Yeah, it's interesting how much the structure or the environment that you live in impacts whether you're able to sustain thought or a heart feeling. Now, Terry, when you said you were frustrated, I want to go back to that feeling, that knowing that you had. What were you measuring yourself against? Because when we talked before, you said that you felt inspired to do something big. And I'm wondering if that big still looks the same for you.
You know, it actually has changed. But in my profession, I'm a strategist and a planner. And I think that's something that's natural within me. So when I do see a need, I think my natural tendency is to step back and look at the big picture, try to analyze the situation, and then to devise something like something big. like a school or a program or something that has some structure to it. We're going to have to raise funds. You know, there's going to be
There's going to be planning, Terry.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. That's what big kind of initially looked like for me. And, you know, to be honest, in terms of the school project that we took on, it was almost like it was part of my path to be a catalyst for getting it started, getting the plans up and running. But quickly, other groups and other people got involved. And by the time the project crossed the finish line, I guess you could say, it's not something where I could point to it and say, yeah, that's something that my wife and I did. Like, that's something that a whole bunch of people did from Canada, the U.S., from the Dominican. I think I have to learn that it doesn't always have to be something big. I just have to listen to that little bit of inspiration and take a step and maybe relax a little bit.
You know, as you're talking there, what was coming into me was knowing when to detach, knowing when you've contributed your part, and detaching. And you said that many other people were involved, and that was the beautiful thing. You know, so many people became involved, and it sounds like it was very organic. And maybe the finished product, it didn't finish in the place you thought it would finish. Or did it? I don't know.
No, it didn't, and actually it still continues to evolve. You know, I do feel pretty secure in the fact that my role was to be a catalyst, and it wasn't to go down there and mix cement. It was to just get the ball rolling, and who knows what my role is going to be from here on out, but on that particular project, that's what it was.
Someone's out there, and they're going to really relate to this. Being inspired, wanting to do something substantial or big, not having the time or resources to action it, and then feeling disappointed on some level that it didn't gel. And what we were talking about before was big is relative. So you could do something on a large scale, and that's wonderful, but doing something not so big also has an innate quality and fulfillment to it. Do you want to talk a little bit more about that? Because I know you have an excellent example.
Yeah, sure. When my wife and I have gone on these humanitarian trips, we stay in a little town that's called Sosua, just outside of Puerto Plata in the Dominican. We'll spend a fair bit of time just walking around the town, and inevitably we come across kids that are living on the street, or they're shoeshine boys or whatever. And we always start talking to them, and as best we can, in a mix of Spanish or French or whatever. We'll usually say, listen, are you hungry? Can we take you for a bite to eat? Some of these meetings that we have with these kids end up being some of our most memorable times down there, where we could be involved in building a house for a family or doing a program at a health clinic, some of these more organized things. But what we come away with is it's the one-on-one kind of interactions where it's memorable for us, and you know, we get to just spend some quality time with some kids, and we learn from them, and they learn from us.
Exactly. And when we spoke before, you were saying about having the tea or having the meal, talking heartbeat to heartbeat was truly fulfilling for you as a human being. And for people who are listening, even if you can do a little bit, that may not mean a world to you, but it means a world to the person that you're doing it to. Because everything is relative.
Yeah, and you know, some people might think it's a small thing, but we took these kids for a meal. It really cost peanuts as far as we were concerned. But for them, it might have been the most nourishing meal that they've had in a long time. So there's that part of it. But for them, just to experience that, here are these people, they don't know us from Adam. We show up, we take them out for a meal. There's no ulterior motive. It's just, you know, we just want to show you guys that that people care about you up there, and you know, we're not looking for anything. We just want to get to meet you and get to share a meal
and extend some Cape Breton hospitality.
Absolutely,
because we all know the spirit of the island is much bigger than the island, right?
That's it.
You are listening to Healing Conversations with Mildred Lynn McDonald on Firefly Willows LIVE. More with Mildred Lynn after this short break. Firefly Willows LIVE is proud to support Canine Paw Print Rescue, a new animal rescue group located in Pittsburgh, California. Canine Paw Print volunteers are experienced, dedicated, well-known, and loving. Hardworking, too. Canine Paw Print Rescue exists to rescue, rehabilitate, and ultimately to rehome abandoned, stray, and neglected animals from shelter situations. They work closely with shelters, other rescues, and the community to improve the lives of animals in need. Find them at caninepawprintrescue.tumblr.com or call 925-695-7297 for more information. Donations to support the animals may be made via PayPal to caninepawprintrescue@gmail.com.
Now, Terry, the sustainable part of philanthropic work requires that both sides connect, and there may be more than two or three sides connect in a meaningful way, or it's not really sustainable. So you would have to be nourished from the relationship. Other people would have to be nourished from the relationship. What have you learned about that whole process, about keeping things sustainable over time and across the miles?
For me, it comes down to the personal relationships. There are some people who are involved in projects and they are quite content to give from a distance and anonymously. And in my case, it's not about seeking any kind of credit for it, because as I mentioned, I feel like I've received much more than I've given. It's the personal relationships. I have friends that in these Haitian communities where, regardless of how much time has passed between my trips, I walk into the community and they see me and we both light up with smiles. I guess they know that I'm someone who doesn't have just a fleeting interest. I do care about them, and they care about me back. It just warms your heart.
Why do you not have just a fleeting interest? because you mentioned when you go down and then at the beginning you'd come home and then other things start to move on your plate and the miles are there and the time is there. What did you do to sustain that connection so it was still relevant and meaningful to you?
I don't know if I did anything special. It was just when I did spend the time with these people, it was heartfelt. It was quality time, and I can't help, I guess, but feel that there's always more I could be doing. But, you know, as soon as that comes out of my mouth, I start thinking, yeah, but that's thinking from this materialistic sense of we have more, and we do have more, but on that heartbeat-to-heartbeat kind of connection, I guess I really don't think that's as important. I think I don't have a fleeting interest because, you know, I have friends, I have people that I care about deeply. And I'm always, if I hear people are heading down there, and I'll say, well, look for this person and tell them I'm thinking about them, that I said hello. They're on my mind.
So what I'm hearing from you is that really, if you want to have something fulfilling, something that touches your spirit and your heart, you have to invest yourself, and you have to give the other people you're helping an opportunity so they can invest themselves in the relationship too.
Well, absolutely, because I guess being the recipient of the love that I've felt when I've been in the presence of some of these people that I'm trying to help, it's almost like if you're just sending a monthly donation or something like that. Now, this is speaking from me. If I'm doing that, I'm almost robbing myself of the other half of the equation. I know that it's going to an important need, and I certainly don't want to tell people, like, stop giving to charities. But if there is a chance and you are able to make a connection heart to heart, it just increases the experience exponentially.
The other thing I was really curious about is when you're doing this work and you're on the ground in the Dominican Republic, what type of mindset is useful? Some of the ones I came up with are, we are here to help you, or we're here to learn from you, or we're here to contribute. What would you share based on your experience? Is a healthy mindset that's based in reality and based on your heart?
I think it's we are here to grow with you.
Oh, okay.
If it's done well, I think both sides will feel a sense of personal growth. And in my experience, that mindset can lead to lifelong friendships.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So we're here to grow. I love that. We're here to grow with you.
Yeah.
I'll probably steal that from you. I'm teasing. I'm teasing, but I'm not. Now, the other thing I love to ask you about is, I was reading some articles about the environmental movement, which some people feel has been successful and other people feel that it's not been so successful. But one thing that has come out loud and clear is bombarding people with facts and figures alone doesn't really work in terms of creating awareness and shifting perceptions and actioning change. But people really relate to stories, which are heart to heart. So I'd love to invite you to share a story with our listeners about your experience.
I could share many. I'll tell you, one story that comes to mind is on our very first trip down to the Dominican, we were being taken to a garbage dump. We were told that there are Haitians that basically live and work in this dump. They will scavenge the garbage, usually coming from resorts, to find bottles and things like that that can be returned to make a few dollars. When we were going down the road into the dump, I was kind of mentally preparing myself because I thought, okay, you're going to see something that's a little bit hard. It's not something we typically would know in our culture. And we get around the corner, and there's this group of people that are industrious. They had a system. They were working together. They were happy. They stopped what they were doing and came over and said hello, and they were all smiling. And I remember my wife at the time took this photo of a guy. They called him the jefe, or he was kind of like the foreman, I guess, of the group. His name was Beto. She took a picture of him, and I still have his photo, and I look at it from time to time, because he had this look on his face that just said, I'm exactly where I'm meant to be. It was just complete contentment. And I left there, again, thinking, wow, I have so much to learn. It's a wonderful thing.
You shared with me that you're contemplating, you're thinking about what your next steps look like. People are out there listening, and they may have done some work to help others. How does your process unwind? What does contemplating your next steps, where does that take you?
Well, to be honest, it's not a defined process. It's kind of organic every time. But I came away from the most recent trip. I met my friend Gabby, and he was updating me on his life, and leaving him and saying, okay, he's a 13-year-old young man. He's the breadwinner of his family. He supports his family by shining shoes. Might make $4 or $5 in the run of a night shining shoes. So, you know, it's not that much. And so I came away thinking, okay, I've got to help him in some way. But what that looks like, I don't know yet. And, you know, my mind immediately went to start thinking about, well, the bigger picture. Must be other kids, like, similar situation, and maybe we need some sort of program to empower teenage boys. And now I've kind of come to the realization that that's going bigger than I'm really meant to go.
Yes.
And so I'm thinking that my role is just to focus on helping my friend Gabby on a one-to-one basis. And in doing so, I think growing together is kind of a good mindset, because I know that I'm not there to just give to him. I'm kind of learning from this as well. You know, I don't look at him as a welfare case. He's already been a teacher to me in many ways, and so if I am going to help him, it's got to be in a way that it's respectful of his dignity. There's always that adage of feed a man a fish or teach him to fish. I think there's part of that has to be followed, that you have to.
So he's going to teach you how to fish, right?
Oh, yeah. It's like learning together.
But that's an excellent point, because my sense also, and that's why I asked about the process, is that there are people listening who know, or they have a feeling that it's their job or their destiny to do something, but their mind feels that it's not worthy unless it's big. And then they get in this cycle where, if I'm going to do something, I want it to be big and worthy, but they do not have the resources or the time, or maybe the lifestyle, to allow that to happen. So your approach of recognizing that your role at this point may be to action interaction between two heartbeats, two people, and grow together. If it was me, I would listen to that. I would be quite fascinated. And I'd say, you know, I could tackle that. I could manage that with my lifestyle. And if everybody, you know, if you had 10 people who were inspired, that would be 10 Gabbies. If 100 people followed your example, that would be 100 Gabbies. And if everybody did their bit, well, then there's good stories and lots of growing and lots of fishing.
Absolutely. It's funny, on our last trip in May, we were on a humanitarian trip with a group, and my wife and I were part of the leadership of the team. And it was younger people that came with us, some just graduating from high school, some in university. They saw that we were going out and just meeting kids and taking them out for supper. And so then they were asking us about it. And then they started following our lead. I'm sure that they've had some other personal connections, and it doesn't have to be that one person has the answers for everybody. I think when you step out and you do something that is heartbeat to heartbeat, people may notice it, they may not, but if they do notice it, I think they see that there's something genuine there, and they see, you know, that's something that I can probably do too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, Terry, you're a bit of a philosopher, and I know you. Let's talk about the currency of life. So when there's a situation and there's no money, what is the currency?
For me, it's smiles. It's laughter. In some case, it's tears. But it's those heart-to-heart connections that you form with people that's where the wealth comes from in the currency of life, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well put. I find myself that if you're in touch with nature, if you invest in community and heart-to-heart connections with people and you grow, then your need for money decreases. Being said, you need a house, you need a roof over your head, you need a bed to sleep in, you need somewhere to store your food. That's taken care of. Because the heartbeat to heartbeat, the growth, the sense of community fills you up. Where do you see yourself this time next year?
You know, I see myself with a step forward in helping my friend Gabby in some way. I really don't know what form that's going to take, but I see myself back spending time with some good friends and smiling and laughing and catching up and just enjoying each other's company and growing together.
The simple life.
Yeah.
Yeah. Terry, thank you so much for being on the show today. I know everybody really enjoyed listening to you because you're so real and you're so giving, and you're actually a person who's rolled up his sleeves and walked your talk. And that always merits respect and inspiration. Would you come back and let us know how you're getting along in maybe 3 or 4 months with your projects?
Oh, absolutely. It's my pleasure.
And I guess you're going off now to have a nice cup of tea in Cape Breton.
Well, of course.
All right, then. You have a good day, and we'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
Many thanks, Terry, and we'll look forward to hearing more about your philanthropic work moving forward. And after showing up so authentically, I'm sure that you've motivated a few people to follow in your footsteps in whatever way works best for them. I'd also like to mention that we're delighted to welcome PJ Clark, who was featured in the last segment, back to the show on a regular basis as part of the popular What's Your Prescription for Balance series. And next up, we have the good fortune to connect with two of the most dedicated animal rescue advocates I've ever met. Both have a heart of gold, tons of experience, and have been rescuing animals since they were little girls. In May 2012, they combined their passion, knowledge, and talent to create Canine Paw Print Rescue. They'll offer you compassionate yet practical commentary on dog rescue shelters, dog behavior, and share the benefits of adopting a rescue or special needs animal. This is Mildred Lynn McDonald, and you're listening to Healing Conversations from Los Altos, California. Thank you so much for joining us today. Now, let's join Tiffany and Aaron at Canine Paw Print Rescue in Pittsburgh, California. And if we're lucky, we might even hear one or two bundles of fluff and fur joining us in the background. Tiffany and Aaron, welcome to the program today. Now get this, paw prints on your heart.
Yeah, we definitely try to help the underdogs. We try to help the animals that have great potential, but they just need a little bit of extra help. Sometimes they're a little bit shy or a little bit too scared in the shelter, or they may need some medical attention that someone couldn't provide for them, which is why they become available for the rescue only. So we try to take those dogs and we rehab them, work with them, we get them trained, and then we try to rehome them into the appropriate home for that particular dog.
So if I'm understanding, sometimes people surrender, and is that the right word, surrender their dog?
Yeah.
The shelter. They may have some little problems or they may have some big problems. You guys look at these dogs very lovingly and always know that there is a home for whatever dog is appropriate to be adopted. Aaron, when you go into the shelter, and I understand that would be once a week between you and Tiffany, what is it that you're looking for?
We're looking for the dog that is a little bit more shut down, that needs a little more extra attention, something that the general public is not prepared to take care of, such as maybe a fractured femur or scared in the shelter because of all the other dogs barking. Most of the time, as soon as those dogs get out of the shelter, they relax a lot and we're able to work with them in training and rehabilitation. 96% of dogs have not received obedience training going into the shelter. And half of those pets were not spayed or neutered or have even seen a veterinarian. About 30% of dogs and 30% of cats were only owned for about 7 months to a year, and then they're relinquished to the shelters. And a lot of that is due to lack of knowledge on how to train a dog or a cat. A lot of times they treat them like children. Animals don't understand that necessarily due to the hierarchy that they live in. That's why it's very important for people to receive obedience training together with their animal.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to introduce our little barkers in the background. Tiffany, would you like to share with our audience? It kind of really fits in with the ambiance of the conversation.
Yeah, we have a few here.
And their little names would be?
Well, that one barking is named Simba, and he's actually one of my dogs. He was adopted out a couple of times and returned because he's a very nervous dog and a bit nippy, and so he's not a dog you can just place with the general public.
Tiffany, I have a rescue dog, and you were part of the process, the key part of the process, to with my adoption of Pops, and I believe you had shared with me that he was one of these little dogs that was almost paralyzed with fear, and because he was so scared, a proper assessment at the shelter was not able to be done. Because you have a background in animal behavior, you were able to go in, and I'll let you take it from there.
We usually can go in and get some of these dogs that are just a bit shut down or scared and see the potential. Every animal has that potential to improve. And a lot of the times it just takes a little bit of TLC once they're out, putting them on a schedule, teaching them what we want them to do and not to do, making them feel secure. And Pops was definitely one of those dogs. He never showed any aggression of any kind, but just because he was so timid and shut down at the shelter, they didn't feel comfortable putting him up for adoption. And he's a gorgeous, cute as can be dog that many people would think would have no problem in a shelter, but there are so many just like him that don't make it out because they're a little bit scared.
Now, if you could tell, this would be either for Aaron or Tiffany, if you could say one thing to the general public in terms of what you find fulfilling about your canine paw print rescue, how does it warm your heart? What do you feel your mission is?
Well, I think yesterday was an amazing day when we pulled two dogs that were just totally, again, shut down. And they were potential. One was about to be euthanized the day that we got her. To pull those dogs out of the shelter and to get them into a home environment and to just see the miraculous turnaround within hours of getting them out of the scary situation that they're in with all the big dogs barking around them and stuff like that, that to me is just the most rewarding thing to be able to see and to be a part of. It's just amazing to be able to do work like this and to help the animals. Without rescue organizations, a lot of these animals that are totally adoptable get put down. I think it's about 15 million of them are killed in the United States yearly. So it's quite a large number. Fortunately, we can't help all of them, but the ones that we do help, it's just amazing to be a part of it.
Sometimes when I'm talking to people, they say, when I mention especially the pups as a rescue dog, they say, well, I'd love to do something, but if I went in there, I would be too sad for the other dogs, or I would cry. And my feeling is there's so much that can be done. If you find that going into the shelter is not for you, you can always donate your time or you can donate resources. What do you guys need? What would a rescue organization need and really appreciate in terms of support from the public?
Most important thing you can do is be active, whether that means fostering, that means, you know, sharing things online, donating, you know, old blankets, towels, dog food. It makes a huge difference. We really do need funds, obviously, for the medical dogs. We do get in a good amount of seniors that have never had anything, a dental cleaning. They've never been fixed. They've never had shots. So I don't think people realize quite how expensive that can be. If it's a dental, I mean, you're looking at between $500 to $1,000 just to fix their teeth because of going their life without any care, proper care.
Like a person that never had the privilege of having dental work done.
Yeah.
And you get them midway through their life. It would be quite an adventure from a dentist's perspective.
That and just fostering. If you're not able to go into the shelter, that's understandable because you can't save them all, and it is hard. It is hard to go in there just as much as we do it weekly, if not more than that. In a way, you get used to it, but you never really do get used to it because you just see so many that you want to help, but we don't have enough places to put these animals where they're going to be successful. So that's another important part of us deciding what to take. What kind of a foster home do we have? Do we have someone that's going to be able to handle 5-pound chihuahua, or are they going to be able to be overwhelmed by having, you know, they may want a puppy. That may be too much for them. A lot of people think they want a puppy until they get them.
Cuteness only goes so far.
Exactly. So anyone that's willing to foster, that's directly saving a life, and that's huge. That's, we really do need that.
So food, things like blankets, fostering is so important because that's a physical house and a physical person and a physical place where you can put a rescue dog. Tiffany, I know you have a background in terms of animal behavior, and Erin, you may also have a similar background, I'm not sure, but how has that helped you in terms of assessing the rescue dogs and helping foster families or new adoptive homes deal with their dogs?
Oh, yeah. It makes a big difference to, you know, go in and be able to see that even though this dog's tail is wagging, it may not mean that it's happy or friendly. It can just mean that it's an intensity. You just kind of need to see what the dog's body language is telling you is so much more important than anything else. And what your body language is telling the dog is more important than anything that you're saying. So just kind of teaching people how to interact with their dogs. You know, you may be saying one thing, but your body language may be saying something completely different. One of the number one reasons I get called in to help families that have dogs is kids want to go and give the dog a hug or a kiss, and that means something very different to a dog. Grabbed and squeezed and have their face in your face, that can be a threat. And while some dogs love it or, you know, they get used to it with their people, it's always a potential kind of waiting to happen.
Erin, I know there's some exciting new programs coming out in 2012 for Canine Paw Print Rescue. Can you guys, and Tiffany, can you guys share a little bit about that?
Yeah, I'm very excited about the programs that we have in the works. There's a training program that I'm working on to help with volunteers and such so that they have adequate information in going into the shelter, and like what we were just talking about with dog behavior and knowing, you know, not to look dogs in the eyes, just stuff like that so that they are more aware of shelter situations. I have a bunch of programs with how to handle animals, how to handle cats and training them, same with dog training for even our adoptive family members for the dogs that we have, training behavior and giving information about why it's so important to spay and neuter your animals as well.
Sounds like it's a big educational focus at this point.
Yeah, that is a large part of it. I'm also looking into going into the schools to do these presentations. It really starts with the children and it works its way up. A little presentation at their school, and we're not supposed to hit the dog, mom, that's not right, and, you know, do it this way. It really starts with the kids, and it affects the parents as well. Large part of it is education, and so that is a big part of what we are trying to do as well.
I want to let our listeners know that we will be inviting Erin and Tiffany to come back again. And as part of showing our support for their program, we're going to be doing a spot for them in each of our shows during the month of August 2012. We'd like to leave people with something to think about in terms of animal rescue or rescuing seniors or little dogs that have special problems. Is there any takeaway that you'd like to share with people?
They're having a specific problem with their dog and they don't know exactly what's going on, I would strongly recommend looking at a behavioralist or talking to your vet or somebody to help before you feel that you need to surrender that animal over to the shelter. It does make it just that much worse for that animal to not know why it's in this little wire cage or in a little cement cell and confused, and, you know, just reach out for help. And there's so many avenues to get help and stuff like that with a behavioral situation.
So if someone's listening, maybe there's 3 or 4 options for them to get help.
Your local vet, there's behavioralists that you can look up on Google.
I mean, talking to your local rescue, a lot of them have great resources that are near you. If you call, they get a lot of people asking for help. You know, the SPCA, Humane Society, places like that are a great resource as well. And they also can help people with dogs or cats that have medical issues. There's places that will help you get the procedures that you need for your animals if your only other option is to surrender them.
Okay, so what I'm taking away from this is that if you have an animal or a pet in your home that you're having a little bit of trouble with, there are people out there, either on the internet or in reality, who are more than willing to help. Take that extra step. It will definitely be worth it. And if you do find yourself in a position where you, for whatever reason, you're not able to keep your animal, what would you advise?
It's a tough situation. I mean, we try to do everything we can to help you keep your animal. Yeah, there's a lot of resources that'll help you keep your animal. There really aren't very many good resources to leave your animal. Most rescues are really full at this time. It's difficult. Sometimes there are rescues that will help you place them, but you usually have to keep the animal while that's happening.
People live in fairyland, and they believe that if they take their animal and they surrender the animal to a rescue, that they're automatically going to find a home. So they have great peace of mind.
And if you surrender your animal to a shelter, for example, even though the animal is very friendly in your home and great, I mean, most animals are terrified there. And when they're terrified, they may, you know, do something like a little growl, and that may disqualify them from being able to be adopted to the public. So you may have this adorable dog that you think everyone is going to want, but because it was a little bit scared, it's not available to the public.
People need to educate themselves. And you guys are never going to go out of business because there's always going to be such a huge niche for what you're doing. And I admire and respect both of you so much because you're actually the people who are rolling up their sleeves and treading where most people, for whatever reason, do not go. And you're able to sustain that, and you're able to do that from a heart-centered place. I believe you both should get a standing ovation for that.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. So once again, I'm talking with Erin and Tiffany from Canine Paw Print Rescue. Their tagline is Paw Prints on Your Heart. And I'd like to invite both Erin and Tiffany to let people know how can they get a hold of you.
You can contact us on our Facebook. It's facebook.com/caninepawprintrescue. And that'll bring you to our page where we have lots of animals for adoption, a place where you can donate to help our medical dogs, animals that we would like to help but we need help with medical funds, and also animals that we have that are waiting to get procedures done that'll help them become more adoptable and improve their quality of life. Anything you can do, come and like our page, support us on there. That would be huge help.
If anybody out there has a rescue dog and they have a success story to share, even if it's not from Canine Paw Print Rescue, because you guys have been on the go since May 2012, would that be something you're interested in, to share the love that way?
Yes, we love seeing that these rescue dogs end up in wonderful situations. Just because you get a dog from a shelter or a rescue, you can get the best dog ever. We just love to hear the happy ending stories. We would love to have that. And if anyone has questions or like some advice or support on something, we're happy to help where we can or direct you to someone who can help you more.
Excellent. Erin and Tiffany, thank you very much. Once again, Erin and Tiffany are from Pittsburgh, California, and we're looking forward to talking with them again during the month of August.
To learn more about today's guests or one of the topics discussed, go to fireflywillows.com/LIVE. And for more information about Firefly Willows LIVE upcoming shows, visit our page at blogtalkradio.com/fireflywillowsLIVE. Thank you for joining us on today's episode of Firefly Willows LIVE. We hope you enjoyed the show. Tune in next week for Revolution with High C, when we'll connect and communicate with the angels. Hear a message from the angels for all those listening. Join the conversation with High C's guest, Nathaniel Evans, a musician, singer, and teacher who believes that music is a direct conduit to the divine that anyone can use to establish their own direct connection with divinity. Nathaniel works and communicates with the realm of the angels and will be offering on-air readings and messages to our listeners in the last half of the show. So call in for your personal angel reading and hear what the angels have to say for you and your life. Plus, our roundtable topic will be a thought-provoking discussion about what it means to thrive versus survive. All this and more on the next episode of Revolution with High C. This is Deb Caracella. Please join us next Sunday morning at 10:30 a.m. Pacific Time on Firefly Willows LIVE, Blog Talk Radio.